Well, last week we looked at the book of Judges, which in many ways were the dark ages of Israel. Thankfully, this week, God's Word shows us that despite all appearances, there was faith to be found in Israel in that day, and that despite the decay of the people as a whole, a simple and beautiful piety had not vanished. That is but one of the joys to be found in the book of Ruth, which Edersheim calls a sweet contrast, almost like a summer's morning after a night of wild tempest. It's a contrast to the history of its time in Judges, because the period of the Judges is the setting for this romantic short story. Now, the book was likely written in the early reign of King David, and actually closes with David's genealogy. In that sense, it is a natural bridge to the book of Samuel and of the monarchy. In fact, Jewish tradition believes that Samuel was its author, as well as being the author of the book of Judges. However, formally, the work is anonymous. The setting of the book is in the latter years of Judges, when the land west of the Jordan was largely at rest, but the land east of the Jordan was still under bondage to the Ammonites. Yet it was not uncommon, as we saw last week, for nations like the Ammonites to launch raids across the Jordan into Judah. This may have been the reason, or it may have been natural, that the book opens with a famine in the land, and specifically it mentions Bethlehem. Now, it must have been severe, because the word Bethlehem means the house of bread. Bethlehem and its surroundings were the breadbasket of Judah. It was the heart of her grain production. And so if Bethlehem was suffering, it was likely widespread. And we might expect that for a land that was under God's discipline, as Judges shows us. Now, one of the wonderful things about the book is its picture of the preservation of a simple, primitive piety and community life. And in this case, in the lives of the family of Elimelech, a son of Bethlehem. Yet even true believers can fail to trust, and such was the case of Elimelech. In the face of the famine, Elimelech took his wife and two sons and fled into Moab. Now, he might have thought he was following ancestral history. Remember, Abraham and Jacob both had fled Canaan in famine. Yet there was a crucial difference here. For the patriarchs, Canaan was a promise yet to come. For Elimelech, the land was a promise realized. Whatever the parcel of land in his name, it was a birthright given by divine hand and not to be exchanged lightly. Hadn't Esau exchanged his birthright because of he was famished? And not to mention that while the Moabites were not under the ban, they were contentious with Israel. And as idolaters, they were contentious with Jehovah. So there is a judgment that the original readers would have understood when Elimelech and his two sons die in Moab. Having died outside of the land that it had taken so long to attain, they were strangers in a strange land. And here's where the story really begins. Now, his wife, Naomi, was a widow. And her two Moabite daughters-in-law were childless, all three left desolate. And one writer has summarized the irony. He says the father had feared not being able to live at home in Israel, but scarcely had he arrived in the strange land when he died. The sons sought to found a house in Moab, but their house became a grave. They did not wish to return to Judah, at least until the famine had ceased. Yet when it ceased, they were no more. The father had gone away to have more and to provide for his family, and his widow was now left without either children or possession. Then word came that, quote, Jehovah had visited his people to give them bread. God sends plenty or he sends lean, all in the secret will of providence. And Naomi saw this as a call to return home. And on the way, her daughters-in-law kept her company. That was the custom. But when she felt that their duty had been fulfilled, she gently dismissed them to, quote, their mother's houses, and with a prayer that the God of Israel would give them rest and new lives. Edersheim gleans from the text a delicate warning that if they followed her to Israel, they could only expect to remain forever homeless and strangers. She could not offer them husbands and families. No pious Israelite in the land would marry a Moabite. So she sends them away with tears. Chapter 1, verse 9 says, "May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." And so in this was a noble act of self-sacrifice, that by speaking the plain case, she would likely end up facing, quote, a dark future, utterly childless, alone and helpless. And yet Naomi pleads for them to return. She says this, "No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter for me, for your sake, that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." So one daughter-in-law heeded Naomi and turned back, quote, to her people and to her gods. But the other was Ruth, and in spite of fully understanding Naomi's meaning, she clings to her and begs to follow, to give up her people, her prospects, and the religion of her ancestors. And she speaks those beautiful and well-loved words. She says, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." Now notice she uses a divine name and her awareness of an existence beyond death. Most commentators see in this exchange the fact that Ruth had made her choice long ago, a deliberate choice of the heart which belonged to the God of Israel. Edersheim is one of these, and in his opinion, in the face of the poverty that Naomi had placed before her, quote, "The choice of Ruth is wholly unaccountable, except on the ground that she felt herself in heart and by conviction one of a Hebrew household, an Israelite woman in soul and life." Now, when they finally reach the little village of Bethlehem, it creates a great stir, especially amongst the women. And Naomi tells them, she says, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara," which means bitter, "because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi," which meant pleasant? "The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So she who left pleasant returned bitter. And soon the widow and her foreign daughter were left to their poverty. And the text says that it was the time of the barley harvest, and Ruth then goes out to glean from the fields. In the Mosaic law, there were a number of provisions for the poor and widowed. Among them was the precept that when a man harvested his crop, he was not to go to the very edge of his property, nor was he to go behind himself or his harvesters and pick up the leftovers. These belonged to the poor and to the stranger. By divine right, even the impoverished shared in Israel's blessing. But of course, it still depended on the piety of the owners to keep this law. And so Ruth goes to the fields in hopes of finding favor in the sight of a field owner and reapers. Now, the field she happens to go to belongs to Boaz, whom she does not know, but is of some relation to Naomi's deceased husband. How close a relation is a matter of debate. In any case, Ruth asked the chief servant for permission to glean after the reapers and to, quote, "gather in the sheaves," which she does receive. So she followed them all morning until Boaz arrived at midday. He asked, "Who is this woman who is gleaning the field?" He's told it was the Moabite who returned with Naomi. By this time, Ruth's goodness towards Naomi was now well known, and Boaz tells his servants to make sure no one interferes with her, and tells his reapers to quietly pull out stalks from their bundles and drop them between the sheaves so that she would find them. He then tells Ruth to go to no other field and says to her, quote, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And so she gleaned all evening. And then when she returns, she tells Naomi, and Naomi is overjoyed. And for the first time, it is mentioned what becomes the central principle of the book, which is the fact that Boaz is a kinsman redeemer. Chapter 2, verse 20. Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Now, redemption is used in a number of ways in Scripture, all of them related to the idea of buying back or of restoration. Initially, the word enters into the Scriptures as the payments for the firstborn of Israel. You recall that in the Passover, the firstborn of Israel was just as forfeit as the Egyptians were. And by sparing them, God established a claim upon them for service. It's essentially the debt of life one would have to the person who saved you from death. But in the place of the firstborn, that is the firstborn of Israel, God took the Levites. And so every firstborn in Israel had to be redeemed or purchased back from the Levites, or more correctly, to be purchased from God's Passover wrath. That is the redemption that all others touch, at least tangentially. The word redeem is also used of the release of persons from slavery. But buying the freedom of the enslaved is still but a reflection of what God does. And it was also used of the recovery of property that had passed into other hands, just as Christ received what had passed into sin, or had recovered what had passed into sin. It's this last aspect that is central to the book of Ruth. The distribution of the land had been anticipated in the Mosaic Law, and the expectation and reality was that each family received a rightful portion. However, recall that Israel was a theocracy, and the land actually belonged to God, meaning that families only possessed the right to use the land. But if needed, the family might have to sell this right of use, or could lose it by having no heir. But in each case, according to the law, every 50 years, in the year of Jubilee, all the lands returned to their ancestral families or to the nearest kinsmen who had the right and responsibility to redeem the property, that is, to buy back the debt. One final aspect, closely related here, was the custom of Levirate marriage. Under the law, a man was required to marry his brother's widow if she were childless. The intent was to produce an heir in his name so that his lineage would continue, and of course to sustain his widow as well. Now there's a lot of debate over to whom this applied, partly because of the book of Ruth, as we're going to see. So that's the setting. And first Naomi has invoked God's blessing on the unknown benefactor, which was a return to the language of thanksgiving instead of bitterness. And then hearing who it was, she now sees the spiritual meaning. Quote, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." In the words of Edersheim, he says, Naomi had murmured. In her unbelief, she had complained. She had deemed herself forsaken of God and afflicted. All the while, however, she and hers might have erred and strayed, God had never left off his kindness either to the living or the dead. Now, for at least the next 2 months, until the end of the harvest, Ruth quietly gleaned the fields of Boaz. But Naomi has hopes for her daughter-in-law, so she has Ruth put her reputation and expectations to risk by seeking redemption from Boaz. And Naomi gives her specific customs to follow. In her best garments, she goes to the threshing floor where Boaz was winnowing his grain. She does not interrupt his work, nor interrupt his dinner. But when she sees that he is laid down to sleep, she carefully lifts the cover and lays herself at his feet. At midnight, she accidentally wakes him up, and being startled, he calls out, "Who are you?" And she replies, "I am Ruth, your servant, for you are a redeemer." Now keep in mind the cultural difference between then and now. Boaz sees nothing unusual or unbecoming in what she has done. In all, there is nothing but purity and goodness. And in fact, Boaz praises her conduct. He says in chapter 3, verse 10, "You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men." The context being here that he praises her for pursuing the custom that would give Naomi an heir through her instead of breaking the lineage by marrying outside of the family. So he is both pleased and gentle and reassuring. And he says, "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman." However, he explains to her that there is a nearer kinsman whose claims would have to be set aside first before Boaz could redeem her. So early the next morning, Boaz goes to the gate, which was the usual place for legal and business transactions. He waits until the nearer kinsman approaches him and has him sit down, and then calls together 10 elders to be witnesses. And there were two objects at legal question here: the redeeming of Ruth as a childless widow and the redeeming of family land. The first was considered a duty. The second was considered a privilege. Marrying your brother's widow was a duty to the memory of the brother, but redeeming land lost due to poverty was in fact a gain. It would have been inappropriate to accept the privilege without fulfilling the duty. In other words, the property and Ruth were attached. To quote another, "It would have been the grossest injustice to have allowed the privilege of redeeming a property to the kinsman who refused to act as a kinsman." So this was the essence of the discussion at the gate. First, Boaz sets before him the privilege of the kinsman redemption of the land, and this he accepted. But then Boaz reminds him of the duty towards Ruth, and that if he refused the duty, he would then forfeit the privilege. This unnamed kinsman chooses to forfeit. The agreement was then ratified by the custom of passing the shoe of the kinsman to Boaz. That represented the passing of his rights to the other. And so Boaz announced that he had bought all that belonged to Elimelech and his sons. And quote, "Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead." And thus Ruth was redeemed. Now the last chapter closes with Ruth becoming the wife of Boaz, and her conception then, and birth of a son. But in that framework, the child himself was a redeemer. It was the redemption of Naomi. Upon his birth, the woman said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." And you can see the far greater intimacy and timelessness in the Hebrew concept than of family, as the villagers announce that, quote, "a son has been born to Naomi," though the son actually came from Ruth. And the child was named Obed. And the last verse of the book of Ruth reads, "Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. And of course, from David came Jesus." And Edersheim closes his commentary with two exceptional points. That, quote, "the story that began in poverty, famine, and exile leads up to the throne of David. And that it is the only instance, quote, in which a book is devoted to the domestic history of a woman. And that woman, a stranger in Israel, and the only other one, was Mary of the Old Testament." This is who the text is describing, essentially, was Mary of the Old Testament. So that's the narrative. Regardless of any other considerations, it is a beautiful piece of literature, one of the finest of the ancient world. The object of the book appears to focus on four things. One, Ruth appears to be a supplement of sorts to Judges, a contrast to its darkness. It is God assuring us that in the most dismal of times, His chosen still remain. Second, which is like it, to show the true spirit of Israel, the sweet and simple piety of redeemed people. Third, to show once more, as Edersheim puts it, the mysterious connection between Israel and the Gentiles. And then fourth, to trace the genealogy of David. All four interwoven, especially the last two, because the book stands on the threshold of the reign and spirit of David and reminds us that Israel's great king, quote, sprang from the union of Ruth and Boaz, which is symbolic of that between Israel and the Gentile world. And along the way, I think modern readers can discern how our conception of family pales in comparison when we see the familial bonds God breathed into Hebrew society through His law. Individualism would have been completely out of step in that culture in its stress upon lineage and heritage and family unity. That emphasis is marbled into the texture of the Mosaic laws under which Israel lived, and it raised a question within Ruth, which is, what was the real extent of the kinsman redeemer? How close a kinsman did this apply to? Because of Boaz, some believe the redeemer concept was broadly applied, much broader than the strict provision in the law. That may be true. Israel may have taken to heart the spirit of the law, applying it beyond the letter. In the law, redeeming family property was rather broad, but redeeming a childless widow was only the legal obligation of a brother. But I think that's part of the lesson. In reality, Boaz was under no legal duty to redeem Ruth. That's why the closer kinsman could decline it, meaning that Boaz redeemed Ruth out of grace, not out of law. But the book itself is really a story of a different redemption. The book opens and closes with Naomi. She had left her birthright. She had chosen to leave the land of God's presence. She had lost everything. Worse, she had grown bitter at God. She saw nothing but judgment in His hand towards her. And yet in the end, God is the one who remains faithful by bringing her back. And it is the child that Ruth bears who becomes her redeemer. The words spoken to her by the village women celebrate God's covenant love to Naomi. Naomi could be Israel. She could be you and I, bitter under discipline, yet one day coming to see the grace that accompanies it and knowing ourselves to be redeemed by the Son of another. Jesus Christ, Son of God, and in the flesh, a son of Ruth the Moabite. And that closes the book of Ruth.